Welcome to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Each episode, LRB Health's Keith Viglioli will talk to the healthcare insiders who are helping to fundamentally transform our healthcare industry.
Hey, everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. I am here with Keith Viglioli of LRB Health. Keith, we'll talk about today's guest, but I need to talk about your previous guest, Mark Cuban. I listened to the podcast this morning, honestly, because I wanted to talk to you about it. And it was very well done. I know you weren't feeling well, but I didn't really pick up on it. I know you a little bit, so I'm like, I could kind of hear it. But if you hadn't told me, I probably would have been okay. But in listening to him talk, I think I kind of slipped into a state of unconsciousness, because when he was done talking, I had like a pitchfork in one hand, then a torch in the other. And I just wanted to burn the place down, because his insights on the healthcare system were like spot on and infuriating. So very engaging and entertaining conversation. Thank you for putting that one on.
Yeah, it was fun. As I said in the preamble earlier, when we were prepping, like, it was the most feedback we've gotten from an episode yet. And go figure, because Mark is such a great person and great thinker and the most down to earth scale, which is the most impressive part about, I think, Mark. And it was funny because, yeah, I went from literally my bed to like jumping on the computer and doing that recording, because the last thing I wanted to do was try to reschedule with Mark. I'm still pissed at myself because I didn't talk about the Celtics and wanted to lead at the end of that interview, and I totally missed it and forgot about it. But anyway, but it was a good episode. And I think it kicks off this kind of great disruption pattern or thought pattern in all things pharmacy. My partner, Josh Flum, who you know, and I have been spending a lot of time just thinking about pharmacy disruption, given how much money in our system and how some aspects of dysfunction are in that particular area. And then ultimately, and obviously Mark saw this and states it well in that interview, then our second guest, Dr. Troy Brennan, counters some of that a little bit, which is our point, right? So Mark is out on the bleeding edge of disruption and trying to think about, he doesn't care what has happened in the system, what happened. He believes this is the way you should go about thinking about disruption in pharmacy and the categories that he's focused on. And then Dr. Troy Brennan in this second episode is really kind of countering that, because he's on the inside and he's been doing this forever. And he's kind of saying, here's a couple of reasons why some of the systems are in place, let alone why they're in place and the efficacy of some of this. So it's an interesting point counterpoint two episodes, I think.
I should listen before I do anything with my torch and pitchfork, then, to make sure I get both sides.
I think your assessment's dead on. I just think we purposely did this where we brought somebody way out on the edge.
Yeah.
And disrupt from the outside. And then the second episode brings somebody that's very deep on the inside to kind of counterpoint some of it. And I don't know if there's a right answer in either of them, but I think there's a way through in analyzing the situation, what our goal is. And most of it centers around the big elephant in the room, which is really about PBMs and the value or lack of value of PBMs, or the transparency or lack of transparency of PBMs and what they do and what they don't do. Mm-hmm. If you really listen closely to Mark's stuff, that's a lot of what he's talking about. There's some pieces in the puzzle in pharmacy that don't make much sense, aren't transparent, aren't trustworthy, all those kind of things that he brings up. And then if you take an insider view, there may be some reasons for that. And there's actually some good of those things that got put in place over the years. They might not be perfect, as I think Troy says. But, you know, Troy's got a pretty elaborate background in understanding what the mechanisms and the why for some of these functions in the space. And that's sort of why we wanted to bring him on. So I think it's like, I hope everybody that got excited about Mark, because who Mark is, gets as excited about what this next episode is with Troy, because he has a lot of really interesting points. And Troy is a well-known, well-respected insider for many, many decades in the space, one of the foremost experts, frankly, in a lot of things, let alone pharmacy. And so it's a really fun two-episode approach so far.
That's great. And just for folks who may not know, Troy Brennan is the former executive vice president and chief medical officer at CVS Caremark. And he's now an adjunct professor at Harvard School of Public Health. So he's been inside industry. Now he's in academia, which kind of gives him a perch where he can maybe be a little more dispassionate, a little more unbiased. So that's a unique and, I think, valuable perspective. One quick takeaway, any quick takeaways from the conversation, something people should listen for?
I think just balance. I've held a bias for years, maybe because from my premier days, that we should be blowing. I'm kind of probably more on the Mark side historically about blowing up the PBM infrastructure and thinking about it differently from a full transparency and blowing up the rebate approach and all the things that people point out. But I think Troy brings up a lot of really good points, and my partner Josh does as well. And both of them obviously come from their past backgrounds in CVS about why some of those things are there. Now, both of them believe that it's not perfect, but there are some controlling mechanisms and some utilization levers that are good, regardless of some of the economic incentives and some of the pass-throughs that happen based on some of the lack of transparency. So I hope people listen to both episodes and they get a very balanced outsider view and then insider view and sort of decide from their own perspective what's the right path forward. And we got a lot of pages to turn in pharmacy because, again, we're spending so much of the healthcare dollar in pharmacy, and that's only going to be more given what we're seeing in pharma these days and some of the life-changing therapeutics that are coming through the pipeline. You know, the one thing that we touch on, Troy and I, as a final point here, is medication management and medication use going to become the dominant care protocol? So like, if you think of oncology or cancer patients, you know, there's a couple of what I always call the three-legged stool in cancer. There's surgery, radiation, and there's drugs. But if oncology drugs get better and better and better, which they have gotten, is the first line protocol going to just be drugs? Is medication management trump everything else, and surgery, radiation, et cetera, become secondary and tertiary kind of approaches from a care protocol? And then what does that mean to the system? Because those are huge shifts in utilization at health providers that they have to plan for. So this is like a really interesting decade-long thought pattern, or maybe even two-decade-long thought pattern about utilization shifts on care protocols or first-line approaches to different disease indications based on what's happening at pharma. We're spending so much time on this topic because we think long, and so this is a really big, long thought pattern for us.
I know it's an ongoing discussion in the medtech world with GLP-1s and the impact it's having on device intervention there. So I think at the end, I think we could all agree we'd all rather take pills than do any of those other things. So let's hope it leads to someplace positive. So this is, just to recap, this is episode 2 of a 3-part series of episodes that will focus on pharma. So
yes, we are going to hopefully record here in the next couple of weeks, the final part of this series. And we look forward to getting that done and getting that out. And then we'll move on to the next set of things.
All right. I'll listen to all three before I take any drastic actions and with my pitchfork and my torch. All right. Let's begin this conversation with Troy Brennan. Again, he's adjunct professor at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Healthcare is Hard podcast. As some folks may remember, we started our little mini series around all things pharmacy, and I could not be happier than to have our current guest on the second episode after Mark Cuban, Dr. Troy Brennan. I've had the luxury and the distinction of also being taught by Troy, which is fun. So we can tell that story some other time, but I can't say I actually obviously enjoyed your class a ton when I was getting my MPH, Troy, but great to have you on the podcast.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you've got probably one of the more interesting backgrounds, and I don't think it's ever a topic that we can pass by you that you can't comment on, but we're going to try to stay focused today on pharmacy. And I'd love maybe just to start all this, Troy, like, how did you even get here? I mean, you got this really interesting JD, MD background, and you did so many interesting things at obviously CVS and a bunch of other spots, and would love just to understand that better.
Yeah, well, I was originally sort of an academic. I was at the Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health, and I was doing mostly sort of health services research and writing about health policy, but I was also practicing at the Brigham Women's Hospital. And I began to get involved in the administration at the Brigham, and then, you know, over time took over sort of negotiations and managed care there. And I worked on behalf of the physician group, and I got interested in sort of the whole administration of healthcare. And I've been there about 15, 18 years or something like that. And it was a good situation. I was a professor and had tenure and also had very interesting sort of administrative job. But Jack Rowe, who was running Aetna, asked me to consider coming out there and working for him, with him. And I was interested in exactly sort of how the insurance companies worked in particular. And I went over to Aetna for about 3 years and then really wanted to get back to be based in Boston. And CVS was looking for somebody to sort of do their healthcare stuff. And I applied for that job and got it. And then I stayed at CVS almost 15 years and oversaw a lot of the sort of healthcare policy, healthcare administration, some of the strategy stuff there. So it was very interesting and rewarding. And now I've been retired about 2 years and I'm back at the School of Public Health at Harvard doing mostly teaching and a good deal of writing.
Yeah, I think you're still at CVS when I took your class. So
that's right.
So you don't see it much, but when you see the JD next to an MD, you know, occasionally I see it. When you sit and think about that, obviously it was a long time ago when you got it, but did that help you through all those stints? Did that help you through a different lens of understanding the nuances and the detail because of some of that training?
Yeah, when I went to medical school, I knew I wanted to sort of do like MD, PhD, and PhD in some sort of social science. So I was at Yale and I went around a variety of different places, the business school, the philosophy department, and the law school and other places to take some classes during my first 2 years of medical school. And the law school was the most interesting one. And I sort of used that. That was my academic shtick, as it was. I wrote about issues in between law and medicine. The first big study we did was a study of medical injury and malpractice, for example. So, I mean, I've always found now in the writing I'm doing, I've always found sort of having a good understanding of the sort of legal perspective of things is a very helpful way to see a lot of issues in healthcare, especially helps with the regulations.
Yeah, I think it's greatly underappreciated. I can say when I did a little bit of studying on public health law, I was astounded at the nuances associated with what you can do and what you can't do on the public health side of the equation in various state, let alone federal regulations.
Yeah, it's like your previous guest, Mark Cuban, kept saying, you know, read the manual. So I've always felt like it's helpful to sort of read the manual. And a lot of the manual in health policy is the legal manual.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you step back, one of the things I've appreciated on a lot of your writing is sort of understanding what Mark and I were talking about a little bit at the end of the interview was it was really about PBMs. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what PBMs are, what they're not, as well as the history. And you've been in it for a long time. I'd love to maybe shed a little bit of light, kind of 101 in your mind on the history and the overview of PBMs, and then bring that up to current day. And we can talk about some of the issues associated with that. But I think grounding of an understanding of what it is and what it isn't, I think would be good to start some of our discussion.
Yeah. And I would say I approach things fairly academically my entire life, but certainly now. And but also combined with my experience over the last 30, 40 years, there's no good people or bad people. There's no people trying to sort of pull the wool over the eyes of other people. And there's no victims and no people who are sort of winning. I like to read the law, but I tend to sort of pay attention to market incentives. And if you pay attention to market incentives, you can understand everything that goes on in even the most arcane areas. And we do have to agree that pharmacy commerce is really arcane. You know, it's not open to view very easily. I know when I went to CBS, it took me a couple of years to sort of think I had a good grasp of all the nuances. But if you look back, again, these things don't start. It's not like they started yesterday. They started years ago, and the historical approach is very helpful. And the original PBMs, and there's been a couple of good reviews of this. eBay and the group at Hopkins wrote a short journal article about it, but Lawton Burns, his long book, he's got a long book on GPOs and PBMs that explains everything about how they operate. But if you look back to like the late 70s, early 80s, there were two influences that were occurring. One was that people were trying to get automated in terms of the payment of pharmacy claims. Remember, most pharmacy claims back then were not covered by insurance. And so the card manufacturers, in particular PCS, began to get a way to sort of adjudicate the claim using your pharmacy card. And at the same time, there were people who were experimenting with mail order pharmacies, thinking that was going to be a much more efficient way to go about things than retail pharmacies. And the original PBM sort of brought those two things together, basically sort of, and the big influence was mail pharmacy and then adjudication. And so if you think about PBMs as doing six things, those are still a baseline, really important part of what they do, in particular the mail pharmacies, although they haven't grown over the course of the last two decades the way that many people thought they would.
So you hit on that, but you and Will Schrank had a good article in Health Affairs not too long ago. I think it was last summer. One of the things you guys talked about was this idea of six different techniques that PBMs use to lower costs. So can you get into those a little?
Yeah. The first is a mail pharmacy, and that's number one, and we explained that. And then they source generics. So all of the PBMs now combine with a number of wholesalers and retailers into two or three really huge generic sourcing organizations. And they buy generics from all over the world and literally hundreds of thousands of different doses and compounds. So it's a big business and they buy the best. And generics are very well priced in the United States as a result of using that market leverage. So that would be number two. The third thing that they began to develop back in the early 90s was basically sort of, well, I'd say two approaches that came straight out of the insurance company playbook. One was tiering using copay. So either use copay or deductible and out-of-pocket payment and creating tiers to try to drive use of generics because PBMs, that's originally sort of what they were oriented towards was driving use of generics. And they've done a good job there too. Generic utilization in the United States has always surpassed Europe, for example, and still does, and now is above 90%. And the tiering is something that I think you can, it's a good explanation of why we've gotten such high rates of use of generics. And then, so that'd be three. And number four is basically utilization management. And utilization management is a lot easier, prior authorization in the pharmacy space than it is in the insurance space, because in the insurance space, there's no playbook, but in the pharmacy space, the FDA approves a drug for these indications. And so you get a lot of attempted utilization of drugs for things either that people are sort of pushing the envelope on or just don't understand. And so prior authorization, utilization management would be the fourth thing that they do. And those four things, you know, basically mail pharmacy, purchasing generics, tiering and using copay to drive use of generics and utilization management are all pretty understandable. And I think not really part of the sort of hidden aspects of what a PBM does. But the other two major things they do is, and the fifth is they assemble a pharmacy network. Just like if you're an insurer, you assemble a market of hospitals and surgical centers and things like that. They assemble their market of pharmacies. And they say, they negotiate with the pharmacies and they say, this is what we're going to pay you. And the pharmacy, of course, owns the medication. The PBM briefly buys it and then sells it to the insurer, which makes it a little bit more complicated. But that pharmacy networking, developing the network, is really no different than what you do as an insurer. The problem is, though, a place where it starts to get very difficult to see through, lack of transparency, is the way in which they do the pricing. So it's mostly on a MAC basis, maximum allowable cost, and that MAC pricing changes all the time. And it contrasts with what the pharmacy's doing with usual and customary sort of reimbursement. And a lot of times people will sort of play, I don't know, say play games, but they'll pay different amounts for different generics. So it does create confusion, and especially confusion for the individual who's there. Because you never, as many of us go into the pharmacy, when we get our prescription, we don't know if it's going to be $300 or free. It's just a seemingly sort of luck of the draw. And I think that this is where you're facing new competition on basically a pass-through model where we're going to say exactly what we bought it for and we're going to prohibit spread pricing. So the newer PBMs, so-called new startup PBMs like SmithRx and others would basically try to use much more of a sort of straightforward model and try to abandon MAC pricing. It'll be difficult to do that because most people aren't prepared to sort of take on the huge number of permutations that go along with the number of drugs that are available and the number of dosage formats that are available. But that's one place, that sort of pharmacy network number five is a place where people can't really see through things. And then the sixth is on the brand side. And first lesson of pharmacy commerce is there's generics and then there's brands. And the way in which that commerce flows is completely different. And they're taking advantage of the pass they got from the federal government in terms of not seeing rebates as kickbacks. The whole industry developed a rebate-based phenomenon where the negotiations with the manufacturers based on formulary, and I have to say, you know, we pushed that as far as possible by basically doing the first formulary exclusions back in 2011 and 2012. But formulary placement, especially when there's competing brands, can really lower prices, and those lower prices come in the form of rebates. And then PBMs used to hold on to a lot of those rebates, but the architecture of competition between the PBMs is such that the majority, the overwhelming majority, most situations, sort of 98, 99% of those rebates go back to the individual clients. And clients like to get rebates because it's a check that they can do whatever they want with it. But it's not the kind of thing where people are going to be willing to sort of say, this is what the price was and this is what my rebate was. They treat that as top secret information and people don't like that lack of transparency either. But you can understand those are the six things they do, and they're all sensible from the point of view of how they get started. What becomes insensible is trying to sort of explain the MAC list, for instance, and one drug costs $300 and the next drug costs $3, and you can't understand sort of exactly what the difference was. And that's because the MAC list pricing doesn't have any transparency.
Yeah. And that is that true in your mind? All the controversy, I mean, there's been a lot of controversy over the years, but like there's been a lot of noise lately. Is it kind of on that back end and similar to some of the discussion with Mark, where he's really putting his foot down around, you know, the lack of transparency is sort of the way through for him. Is that where a lot of the noise is from right now with PBMs? And you have one side of the coin where a lot of people are looking at this going, hey, look, imagine what drug spend would be if we weren't putting some of these mechanisms in place with PBMs. On the other side of the coin, you have a lot of people saying, hey, just get them out of the way and let's get a much more transparent system. I'm just curious sort of how you think about the running controversy on the state of PBMs right now, let alone what may or may not happen in DC.
Well, the PBMs traditionally, the people who ran the PBMs, you know, their view was, you know, just keep your head down and be quiet and no one will notice and there's not going to be any controversy. And they were right about that for 15 years from 2000 to 2015. But that's not the case anymore. And you've also had pharma facing its own challenges in terms of sort of the overall costs associated with things. Basically designing a public relations program that's heavily funded that says basically these are the bad guys, these intermediaries are the bad guys. So the average person today, I think after 5 to 8 years of that barrage, thinks that somehow these thieves have sort of foisted their way in the middle of things and they're just making money on everybody. And if we just got rid of them, costs of medications would drop, which is what pharma wants you to believe. But it's not really the case. These things do work and they have kept drug prices, at least in some range. You know, it's you start with a much higher amount than what was being paid in Europe 20 years ago, and it's just continued to sort of inflate from there. So when you look at it compared to sort of the European systems, it doesn't look good at all. But when you look at it compared to the sort of average increase and compare that to your average hospital increases and your average doctor increases, it's less. So I think a big part of it is the PR problem that they haven't been able to solve because they really don't like to be as transparent as they're going to have to be. But now you've got the push from the point of view of sort of the transparent PBMs and Mark Cuban, who I think is having a good influence overall on this. But what he's doing himself is just basically sort of cherry picking off of that MAC list to find places where you can buy the drugs much cheaper than what the PBM is selling them for, because the in some places they've got real bargains on the MAC list, in other places they don't have bargains, and it depends sort of on the PBM and its MAC list. So that in itself will change things. But if you had a PBM that could come in and really offer a pass-through, basically an administrative fee, and pass through the costs, demonstrate sort of what they're buying the generics for, then I think that could provide some real competition. And you can see the PBMs now moving. Since I left 2 years ago, I don't have any contact with CVS really since I left 2 years ago, but you can see what they're doing and what Express is doing in terms of sort of offering in a different model. And as Cuban says, let competition occur. But I think if I'm betting on things, I would suspect that the PBM industry will be able to sort of adapt to this.
Yeah. I think the question on that over time in my mind, and I did talk a little bit, Mark, about this, whereas he capped a certain category to your point of pick list of mostly generic drugs, whether he's manufacturing it or not. And he has an ability to put a cost plus 15% plus shipping on it. And then the class of citizens that they'll never get there. So the question in time, does the PBM industry get away from what has been oligopoly, if you will, you know, a handful of big players that now get specialized into categories based on what's going on, not only at the generic and biosimilar standpoint, but everything that's happening on the specialty medication side, and let alone that up into the right kind of cost structure on more of these designer drugs that, you know, are life-changing. But that's a whole nother set of problems that can a PBM control or not control, or insure doesn't really have a bag of tools, in my opinion, to really kind of figure out the financing mechanism for some of those for the average employer, let alone self-employer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were a lot of questions in that statement, Keith. But the one I would say is that sort of what the future looks like, it could be that these smaller PBMs begin to get some market share, people like them, and employers sort of begin to choose them. But if I had to bet, and I'd say that my probabilities would be higher that the PBMs themselves, the big PBMs, will basically sort of adapt to this. The things that they got going for them is, first of all, the sort of rebating structure is very difficult to build that kind of negotiating strategy and leverage with large pharma. And so many of these smaller PBMs are going to have to buy that, and that makes them relatively non-competitive. And solving the MAC list with a pass-through approach is not something that's going to be difficult for the PBMs. It could actually be more difficult for the retail pharmacies, because the retail pharmacies also make more money when you have those kinds of relatively sort of inflated prices on at least some of the drugs they sell in the retail pharmacy. So time will tell about that. But if I had to sort of predict what was going to happen, I would say the existing industry likely sort of evolves. And the people who run PBMs, and I think I can say this relatively sort of academically without bias, I've always thought that they were more flexible, more adaptable in terms of what their business models are going to be than almost anywhere else in healthcare. Because if you look 20 years ago, what they were dependent on, they were really dependent on retained rebates, and they don't have that anymore. Now it's all the money's being made sort of in specialty pharmacy. That is a whole different area in exactly sort of what happens with specialty pharmacy and how much competition is basically imbued in that by changes either in federal or state regulation is going to be really interesting. But that's where the dollars are today.
Yeah. And then let's move there. Then we'll come back to DC a little bit and regulations. So when you think of that segment of the market, which I think 90% or more of most things in the pipeline now would be classified probably as specialty medications, as that kind of comes through the market more and more approvals happen, how does that market shape? I mean, it feels like we always talk about, Josh and I always talk about here, that are doing a lot of work in that area right now with our partners. It still feels a little wild, wild west out there in terms of distribution, in terms of access, in terms of, you know, how do you pay for these things? What's your feeling on how that segment of the market will shape itself, you know, sort of in the near and the distant future?
Yeah, it's a really important question. I think Cigna just had their investor conference, and there was one slide that they showed that basically saying 2016, 2024, and 2034, something like that. And the drugs become 40 to 45% as compared to maybe 3 years ago, 15% of the overall bill. And that amount in 2034 is worth more than the entire healthcare system was in 2016. So it's an issue of sort of huge importance. And the other thing is, it's just that the arbitrage on the drugs, because the drugs are so expensive, is funding a lot of people. The PBMs are obviously sort of making money on it. The pharmaceutical manufacturers are clearly making a lot of money on it. Hospitals basically taking the arbitrage off their inventory. You talk to the leading cancer centers today, they're making 60 and 70% of their total revenue on drug arbitrage. So what happens here is incredibly important. I can't name a major hospital that is a dish hospital, or at least has availability of 340B, that doesn't find a huge portion of its overall margin based on its 340B dollars. So what happens next is not clear. But the critical thing, as I see it, is going to be basically who controls the drugs through the specialty pharmacy, because right now there's a real, how shall I say, in a lot of places, there's sort of a war going on in terms of, do I have to buy from my PBM specialty pharmacy, or can I get it from somewhere else? Or can I shift it from provider dispense to pharmacy dispense, with pharmacy dispense being the specialty pharmacy? So there's a lot of unsettled aspects out there that I think, you know, as you suggested, have to get clarified over the course of the next decade.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, every actor has their hand out, if you will, because it's driving so much of their bottom line impact. I mean, back to the health systems, we know of health systems that half their profit right now is being driven by pharmacy. And so as those pharmacy operations get bigger, depending on what their footprints look like, it feels a little bit like a grab ball about who's going to not only have distribution and where it comes through, but who's going to own the follow-up. I mean, all the patient issues associated with this. I don't think the average specialty pharmacy patient, if you ask them today, if they feel like it's a smooth process, almost 90, 95% of them will tell you it's awful.
Yeah. And
that's the other question, which is who really starts controlling the mechanism of action for the patient experience around some of this stuff? Because these things are, some are a bit more cumbersome to administer and then let alone manage effects afterwards.
Right, right. Well, you take CAR T, for example, you know, your chimeric T cells. And right now you need a hospital and a very, very special pharmacy to do that. But I'm working on a book on cancer, and I've been talking to a bunch of cancer researchers, and they all see that being democratized, as they say, which means that they're going to basically try to solve the issues about how difficult it is to sort of make the new T cells right now, and then what they call cytokine storm that can occur for people. And a guy that I was talking to today gave me an example. He says, you know, monoclonal antibodies, you know, we used to have to make those in the bellies of mice, and they were like $1 million for a tiny little vial. Now, you know, sort of technology 15, 20 years later, you know, they're basically very cheap. But what happens in that democratization process is it basically, it plays into the hands, I think, of the specialty pharmacies and infusion centers, because, you know, sort of you can't tolerate the costs associated with the arbitrage that the hospitals are making right now, as well as the sort of facility fee. Now, if I'm in a hospital, I don't really want to hear that right now, because that's my bread and butter. But if you think about things from the point of view of having a health system that you can afford, that's probably the way it's got to go. Much more home infusion and much better medications to deal with problems that right now require hospitalization.
Yeah. And we're seeing a lot of that, as you know, like you're seeing an explosion of ambulatory infusion thoughts and folks out in the market right now. And it's going to be an interesting pathway. The other side of this that we talk a lot about, which would be interesting to get your take, is just how do we pay for this? When you talk to the insurers, they're not so sure they have a product for this. When you talk to the self-insured employers, they don't know what they're, you know, doing on this. Stop loss is really not covering some of this if they've got a couple of people with, you know, some of these $1 million plus drugs in their pool. We have yet to figure it out. I would tell you that Josh and I have been putting our heads together for a while now trying to figure out, does the entrepreneur step in here somewhere and think about this very differently? But we're still processing all of it.
Yeah, the entrepreneur might. I think the government probably will have to sooner or later. I was, you know, listening to sort of Mark Cuban talk. He was somewhat critical of the employers for sort of not paying it close enough attention to what was going on. I think that's probably unfair. As I said, most of the people you meet in benefits administration do have a really good understanding of what's happening, and they're well advised by a whole series of consultants. And so I sort of have trouble putting the blame on them. But another book I'm working on, the one that actually is coming out this year, is about what happens with sort of health insurance. And if you look at it, the only way you really get control around these things is price controls, which means the government basically asserts it. And you've got, so I think, you know, the way things eventually go is either you begin to offer something that looks like a Medicare Advantage plan to employers, and they begin to sort of use that instead of what we consider today sort of commercial insurance, or you go to a single payer program. But in both cases, the government names the price for hospitalizations. They name the price for what they're going to pay the physicians. Eventually, they'll name the price of what they're going to pay for medications. The United States can't stay an outlier from all the other advanced countries. All the other advanced countries do that. And the Medicare Advantage programs and Medicare Part D programs are fairly straightforward. They don't have the same sort of set of problems that some of the commercial pharmacy commerce does. So I think they're perfectly good programs. And I guess I'm feeling a little bit like I'm more of a capitalist than Mark Cuban is, and that I would sort of keep private administration in place. But I think that's the only way it's going to go. Entrepreneurs may solve it, but I guess I have to rest a little bit more on the bulwark of government regulation.
And do you ever see a time, just because I happen to know the entity well, but when you think about NICE in the UK, I mean, are we ever going to get to a place? I mean, we have ICER here in town, which is doing its thing. We've got a thing tied up with Tufts called DIG, New DIG, thinking about pricing on these things here in Boston as well. I mean, do we ever get to a government entity, or do we just kind of crawl our way into this strategy similar to what we're doing about some of the other drug classes now in this area?
You know, the IRA is basically the reason why you got 60 different suits by the pharmaceutical manufacturers out there, is because this is the camel's nose under the tent. And the IRA basically sort of moves relatively slowly but deliberately. And that's the way healthcare policy changes in the United States. So I would say that the IRA basically sets that up. And that's why the pharmaceutical manufacturers are so upset about it and suing government in a variety of different courtrooms, because they don't want that camel's nose under the tent. And the reason why is because the IRA does progressively sort of move towards a situation where the government's naming the price. And what they'll use is basically sort of reference price, which is going to be set on comparative effectiveness, or they'll explicitly sort of use comparative effectiveness in their decision making. And that's, I think, it's long overdue. It took us in Medicare till 1983, from 66 to 1983, to get to government, to get to hospital pricing. And then to 93, 94 to get to physician pricing. The whole government involvement in Part D started with 2003. Medicare Modernization Act. So it's about time that you get around to the government naming the price here.
Does seem inevitable. And it seems like some of the, you know, while small creeping legislation that's gone through over the last year or two is kind of on that pathway.
Yeah. The IRA is, you know, it's like 10 and then it's 10 and then it's 20. And so you start to get, you know, sort of many of your most expensive medications. And if they're working on, you know, sort of day where they want to make all biosimilars sort of interchangeable. If you look at the sort of top cancer drugs, they're mostly going generic in the 2020s. There'll be new ones coming through. But if you get a strong biosimilar market, that helps you out a great deal as well. You know, the generics under Hatch-Waxman have been a tremendous success story. There's no more cost-effective intervention in American healthcare than generic statins, for example.
Let's double tap on that and broaden the lens on this. And you and I went back and forth a little bit on the prep on this, and I'll explain a little bit more in our discussion here. We've been thinking a lot about what's happening in the pipeline, what comes through it, how it changes clinical protocol, which again, you're an expert in. And what I mean by that is, like, let's stick with oncology, and then we'll come back to maybe the GLP-1 example, because I think it's a really good one too. But in oncology, if all of a sudden Keytruda comes through and it becomes life-changing for lung, kidney, whatever indication of cancer, and there's no need for surgery anymore as a protocol, or even radiation oncology anymore. Bed management is really the first pass, the second pass, the third pass, because it's really starting to work. And I'm just using Keytruda as an example, because it's obviously those other indications get into play for that. But if more and more good oncology drugs come through, that the clinical protocol is meds and the therapeutic as first line, and then it works for second line, third line. What happens? We've been talking a lot to our health system partners on this. What happens over the better part of the next decade when you start thinking about utilization management? And then I'll finish this with the GLP-1, because I think it's an easier example because it's real, even though it's smaller dollars. As GLP-1s come down, all sorts of things change if people stay on those drugs and the price points kind of hold for sustainability, which includes something as simple as bariatric surgery, which those service lines were at 8 or 10% growth rates for the next foreseeable future. As soon as GLP-1s hit the market, that got cut by most people down to 0 to 2%. And so, like, that's a major utilization factor, not a huge service line as part of the sub-surgery service line for the average health system, but still, nonetheless, it was a growing part of their surgery protocol. If that starts happening in multiple different disease indications because the drugs keep getting better and better from pharma, mm-hmm. How does the average health system plan for that? I mean, they almost have to be back to our grab bag point. They have to be a medication management company, and they have to own specialty pharmacy, and they have to be in that throughput to have sustainability, in my opinion, let alone the issues they have today for sustainability financially.
Yeah. I mean, you make a series of very good points there, and you see it in certain areas, you know, so cardiac surgery programs are not nearly as prominent today as they were 15 or 20 years ago, because of the competition, both from the cardiologists as well as people doing a better job in terms of preventing coronary artery disease. So one hopeful thing about the future would be that's the case. And we've got a ton of generic medications eventually that are helping people deal with illnesses, and we don't have as large hospitalizations. And the hospitals have to sort of rethink things a little bit. My first course in public health school nearly 40 years ago, hospital administration, was basically keep the doctors happy, especially the surgeons, and keep the ORs filled. And that's been the basic game plan for most hospitals and still is today. The only thing they've added on there is get as many hospitals under one signature as possible so as to have leverage with commercial insurers. Those have been the only two strategies they've really pursued. In a situation where they begin to sort of lose some of this procedure-based stuff because the rest of the healthcare system can't afford it, then you have to really sort of rethink things. Well, we're still going to need them for their emergency departments and emergency surgeries, and people at the end of life are going to end up there, but all of a sudden it doesn't foot in terms of sort of what the financial structure looks like today. So I don't know what's going to happen there. You can always count on professionals generally sort of speaking, and physicians and nurses in particular, to sort of create more work so as to create reasonable incomes. They're not bad people. That's what most of us do. But as you suggested, there are some headwinds. When you talk to the oncologists today, that's the kind of world they see, where they think that there's basically low morbidity medications. They're going to treat a lot of diseases that previously were untreated.
And sustainability and post-treatment survival. Like, it becomes a different kind of care protocol rather than the acute episodic three-legged stool approach to most cancers. I think that's the part that we find most interesting as we look long, because we're long investors in all of this and we're trying to understand it from the transformational lens of incumbent players. No one's sitting within their strategic book thinking about that, because a lot of them are trying to keep their lights on this quarter and next quarter and the year ahead. But that's something we see long and hard with this discussion, which is like, if you believe, you know, Josh says this, and he's probably talked to you a lot about it and probably come from some of your guys' CBS discussions. If the only real true innovation, like true innovation in healthcare, sits with pharmaceutical development, it changes your whole approach and mindset to innovation in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Any last thoughts before we close up? This has been great, and I really appreciate you taking the time. We could have talked about 40 other subjects, I know, but this one's timely.
Yeah, I thought the future that you predict is very interesting, or the future you're considering is very interesting. And sort of getting there in between now and then, I was impressed by an article in the New England Journal of Medicine recently on treatment for multiple myeloma. And I can tell you, in the year 2000, multiple myeloma, you were lucky to live a year. This was a three-drug protocol that they were testing, and they demonstrated that three drugs were better than the two drugs, which was a standard protocol. But the Kaplan-Meier plot showed these people, 80% of people living 5 years. So it's like tremendous, tremendous progress overall in our ability to sort of care for people. But on the other hand, I know that each of those three drugs is more than $400,000 a year, and you've got to stay on them. You don't go off them. You get induced, and then you stay on them for the rest of the time you've got the disease. And then some of these people, once they fail that, are going to go to a CAR T approach, which has got somewhere around a million. So you begin to sort of think about it. How are we going to afford this healthcare system? That's really what people ought to be thinking about. And drugs is just one really good prism to understand that.
Well, Troy, great. I appreciate your comments and your thoughts as always, and really happy that we can make this happen. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. If you want to follow Keith Figlioli, he is on LinkedIn. You can find him there, Keith Figlioli. If you want to share this podcast, make sure you copy Keith and myself. We'd love to be part of that conversation. You can find me on LinkedIn as well, Tom Salemi. You can also find me on Twitter at MedTechTom. I'm the editorial director of the Device Talks events and podcasts. So look at devicetalks.com if you're interested in the medical device field. That's it, folks. Tune in next time for another great episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders.